for this hour. I don't feel that he's a stranger to very many of us. I have a personal recollection of obeying the gospel in 1951, and one of my earliest recollections is we had a meeting in the spring, and the man that preached that, who inspired me greatly as a new child in the Lord by the power of his sermons, is the same man who will be speaking to us here this hour. Brother Mid McKnight.
If you lost a little blue pill case here with your pills in it, I got them. If you think you can get through my sermon without it, I'll just leave it laying here. You can pick it up afterward. It's a little blue pill case. Also, I was asked to announce at the other session and forgot to. When you get my age, you get senile. An umbrella down here at the front someone had lost, and so I wanted to mention that to you. Those of you coming in, just come on in. If you're coming in to hear Doyle Maynard, don't. He ain't here. As I understand, he's ill. And I'm sorry for that. He was supposed to be speaking on the subject of you can't eat an oven with snowballs. I think my subject will roll right along with it pretty well. Now, if he gets here, I'll let him have the pulpit because I've got a plane to catch. And not too long. So I told the first class I'll be speaking from 4 p.m. to 4:29 and a half. And then if y'all want to sing or pray or whatever, well, you can have it after that. But I have to leave. I have a schedule foul up this morning and we'll have to catch the last stagecoach out at 5:15. So I wanted you to know ahead of time why I'd be leaving early. It's good to see you here. We're starting just a minute or two early. I wanted to explain about Doyle. I don't know how seriously ill or what. There is a lot of illness, of course, as we all know, that is going around in various and sundry shapes and forms. And we trust that it's nothing that is too serious. After our first session, my first session with you, someone came up and gave me a definition of worldliness, and I'd like to share it with you. I've had a lot of teachers, most of us have, and he defined worldliness as living like eternity does not exist. Can you think of a better definition of worldliness than that? Living like eternity doesn't exist. Doesn't mean you have to go out and be wild and wicked or anything, just trying to make all the money we can or be as popular as possible or whatever. And that was his definition. He told me who he got it from, but we won't bother with that because he got it from somebody else, I'm sure. But nevertheless, I like that definition. I'd like to invite you at this time to join your heart with my heart as we ask God's blessings upon us. Our Father and our God, we're so grateful that you have loved us so richly, that you have been so patient with us. We're so sorry, Father, that we have disappointed you so keenly so many times in so many ways. Father, forgive us for drinking from wells we did not dig and warming by fires that we did not build. Forgive us for getting soft physically, morally, mentally, and spiritually. Please, God, help us to catch a vision of the church as it was in the first century and as it truly is today. In the name of Jesus, amen. The lesson that I have for this afternoon's session is entitled In Pursuit of Excellence. Now, I realize that varies from your program, and we have some here who were not with us earlier. And we had talked about the fact that your attitude determines your altitude in the first session, about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Now, this is just a follow-up on that. And I may say, and will say, one or two things to tie the two lessons together. First of all, I don't think any situation is hopeless. Only men are. When they got the wrong attitude, they're hopeless. We can change their attitude, then things get along just fine. That's the reason that I have one whole album of sermons out on Proverbs 23, verse 7. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. I used this 1 year ago from this pulpit. I think it's worthy of repeating. Some of you may have forgotten it. Please pardon the grammar, but when I hear someone say, well, okay, right now I can't never sell no insurance, buddy, you're right. With an attitude of heart and disposition of mind like that, you can't do it. You'd be a super colossal flop. When I hear someone say, well, I'll tell you right now, I can't ever lead anybody to Christ, you're right. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So I'm going to talk to you about the pursuit of excellence. Now I want you to know the 3 points in this lesson this afternoon, and that I got them from a tremendous young business executive. Oh, they're scriptural, don't worry about that part of it. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and I'm going to tell you what the 3 points are, so you can see what kind of progress we're making. He's a young man who, at age 39, was made president of a $14 billion corporation. There were several other young men in that corporation who were being trained, who were being screened, who were being given executive training. Now, this young man's wife told me, said, Ned, I just know he's going to get the presidency. She said, he makes 100. He gets a perfect score on all of the papers that he sends into this executive training session that this company did sponsor. And sure enough, at age 39, he's made the president of a $14 billion corporation. His picture was in the Wall Street Journal and in a host of other publications. I saw him in Forbes magazine and Dallas Morning News, Dallas Times Herald. And I heard him make a speech with these 3 points. And so here are the points you're going to get this afternoon. I just want you to know they came from a very successful businessman, but he got them out of God's book, and that's what's important. Number one, set for yourself a goal. In the pursuit of excellence, you've got to set for yourself a goal. Number two, determine your obstacles. You're going to have some. Set yourself a goal. Determine what your obstacles are going to be. I just came from a table over at the refreshment booth talking to some brothers in Christ about some obstacles. And then number three, plan how to overcome these obstacles. Now, that's his business principles. I heard him make a talk like this using these. I thought, man, that'll make a good sermon there. And so I told him so. And I'll let him know when I get back home that I use his outline here for you. In the pursuit of excellence. All right, lesson number one, we're going to talk about setting some goals. I know you've heard an awful lot about setting goals. I have one whole sermon on a God of goals. God believed in goals. He set goals. Jesus set goals. Paul set goals. Peter set goals. And yet some of my brethren say, I don't believe in goals. Well, you ought to go to the dictionary and look it up and see what a goal is. It's a purpose. Don't you have any purpose in life? It's an end that you desire to accomplish. Don't you have any ends that you desire to accomplish in life? That's what it all amounts to. Now, it's very important that we learn, oh, it's essential that we learn to set goals if we're going to get anywhere in business or in the Lord's business, with a ball team or anything else. So I'll use some illustrations out of some various fields here in a moment. But I'd like to suggest to you that a woman, oh, I don't know, several months ago, had a small goldfish bowl. And it had too many fish, and they'd grown too large for it. It was about 6 inches across, and they swam in a little tight circle here. She decided one day that she'd clean up the goldfish bowl. It needed it. And so she went in, and she drew about 4 or 5 inches of water in the bathtub. And she was going to pour the fish in there while she cleaned up the bowl. That'd give them a chance to exercise. And so she poured them in the bathtub, and she went about cleaning up the goldfish bowl, and when she came back to get the fish, she was surprised to see them swimming in a little tight 6-inch circle. Why? They'd been in their own little limited vision, in their own little limited circle, so long they didn't know that they could do anything anymore. They reminded me of a lot of my brethren who've been swimming around in a tight little 6-inch circle and the limit of their visibility about 6 inches, and they've been doing it so long they don't know that they can do any better than that. Now, on one occasion some years ago, my older brother, my oldest brother, Clark, he's now deceased, he and I were farming, not as partners, but we farmed, lived as neighbors on the same section of land, and we helped each other out in the busy season, things like that, you know. My wife is a city girl, was a city girl. She now lives in Kaufman, so I don't know what that makes her. But anyway, she just had been used to the ways of the farm, and she and I one day were driving in a pickup truck, we were going over to see my brother Clark. We drove by a big wheat field, hundreds of acres. And out there were hundreds of cows grazing, and not a sign of a fence. My wife said, "What on earth keeps those cows in that pasture?" Well, I knew, but I wasn't going to tell her. I said, "I tell you what, when we get over to where Clark is, my brother, ask him." And so when we got over there, her curiosity just about had the best of her. That's the first question. She said, "Clark," we drove by over there, and she said, "You got hundreds of cows out there, not a sign of a fence." She said, "I want to know what keeps them in that pasture." Now, Clark had a rather wry sense of humor, and he answered one word: gravity. Well, he's telling the truth. That's all they excuse me was gravity. But you see, I knew something my wife didn't know. We learned a long time ago you can stretch an electric fence around the pasture, leave it there about 2 weeks. Cattle, hogs, sheep, goats, and things, they find out when they get over to a certain place that something unpleasant happens to them. And after a while, they begin to catch on when they get over to that edge. Something unpleasant happens, they stay away from them. Well, after they catch on, you take the fence down, move it somewhere else, you see. And that's just like my brethren, bless your hearts. The fence has been there so long that you just don't think you can go past it. How many congregations baptized? Over 100 this year? Well, I don't know. I haven't heard the statistics. Maybe some of you know. But we get our little fences built just like those cows had, you know. And just can't go beyond that. A friend of mine was telling me about going in a fellow's garage. It was noontime. The doors were open. And here's a yellow line drawn on the floor. And he said, "Man, there's a guard dog, a German shepherd. He came running out of the back straight at me." And he said, "I turned around." And he said, "When that dog got to that yellow line painted on the floor, he just stopped." He said, "I couldn't figure it out. There's nothing to make him stop." Well, he found out. Some of you dog lovers, you know that there are electric prod collars you can put on dogs for training them. And whenever they're not doing what you want them to do, you can punch the little button here, it's radio controlled, and they have an unpleasant sensation of getting shot. Well, this man had trained his dog that whenever you get to that yellow line, something unpleasant happens. And so he didn't even have a collar on now, you see. Well, he just, matter of fact, he come running up to that line and throw one all four and just scoot up there. He could have gone on across it. In pursuit of excellence. Now, he's just a dumb beast. You and I made God's own image. We ought to know better than to throw on our brakes just because somebody else hadn't done it. And so we need to set some high goals of excellence. That's number one. May I suggest to you this, that the early church, the church you read about in the Bible, was never put on the defensive. Hear it, please. The church you read about in the Bible was never put on the defensive. It was always on the offensive. Well, we've been on the defensive as long as I can remember. And we're defending ourselves about this, and we're defending ourselves about this, defending ourselves, and people all around us going to hell because we're not on the offensive. Now, I used to coach football years ago, and I never was much of a football coach, but I learned one thing right fast. That my team never could score as long as the other team had the ball. Now, it doesn't take a brain to figure that out. And here we are in the church. Got one woman at home at Kaufman. I just love her dearly. But bless her heart, she's always coming around telling me what the denominations are saying about the church. I don't even care. Man, I could spend all of my time defending. I got more important things to do than that. Now, let's just watch it here about the individuals. The church is made up of individuals. Acts the 7th chapter. Old Stephen is called on the carpet. He is accused. What does he do? Come to his defense? No. Man, he gets on the offensive. And he preaches a sermon there in Acts the 7th chapter that brought a lot of responses, didn't it? May not have been the kind you and I'd like to count. But I want you to know he didn't defend himself. He got on the offensive and he preached the gospel to them. Read it. Acts the 7th chapter. They couldn't take it. They gnashed on him with their teeth. They stoned him to death. But he was not on the defensive. He was on the offensive. Go to Acts 26. Paul is before Agrippa. Paul's being accused. Boy, he doesn't start pleading for his life or anything. What does he do? Read what he does. He gets on the offensive. And he preaches to old Agrippa. And he finally, old Agrippa says, "Paul, almost thou persuadest me to become a Christian. Would to God that not only you, but all those standing here, are not only almost, but altogether as I am," Paul said. And so the church had some goals, and it wasn't just to defend this and defend that. Oh, I know you have to defend things. You brethren know that I know that. Please don't be nitpicky. I told you I just got 29 minutes to preach, and I haven't got time to go into a lot of detail about this. Certainly there are things that you have to defend, but to spend all of your time defending, you're never going to win any souls that way. You have to go on the offensive. Now, let me give you just a statement I made this morning because I think it's worth repeating. An idea that is not coupled to action never gets any bigger than the brain cell it occupies. Any idea you have, boy, I'll tell you what, we're going to go home and we're going to knock on every door in town. And that idea is good. But unless you translate it into action, it'll never get any bigger than the brain cell that it occupies. So let me give you just a few other illustrations. I gave you a whole bunch of them earlier. Mr. DeVos came up with that idea about selling cleaning products to the individual homes. That's an idea. Man, he could have died a pauper. But instead, he translated that into action. And now, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, Amway was selling over $1 million a day of products. It's because he translated that idea into action. And if you don't translate, you got to have the goal first. Then we'll get it translated. Oh, we'll have some obstacles, but we'll get to those in just a moment. Henry Ford decided it was a waste of engineering know-how to have a straight-eight motor. Years ago, he had an idea. He said, let's make a V8 out of it. We'll put all four cylinders here, and we'll make a V8 out of it. Told his engineers about it. They said, it's impossible. He said, do it anyway. Can't be done. He said, I'm paying your salary. Get started. A year went by. He called him in. How you coming? Well, we can't do it. Just absolutely cannot be done. He said, get back to work. 4 years later, they came out with that first V8. Now then, they're countless. But see, that was an idea Henry Ford had. And it was translated into action. And it hadn't been translated into action, never would have gotten any bigger than the brain cell that it occupied. You don't know why some churches are so small? Number one, they don't even have a goal. If they do, they don't translate it into action. Well, let's notice another one. I was in the air wing of the Smithsonian Institute, Washington, D.C., 2 months ago. I went by again to see that plane that the Wright brothers flew. They had an idea. They translated it into action. Saw the Spirit of St. Louis hanging from the ceiling again. I thought about old Lindbergh. He had an idea. He translated it into action. I saw a scale model, a replica, rather, of that first little bitty satellite we put into orbit. About the size of a grapefruit. Man, that's a great day for us. Yes, it was. Not making fun of it. But that was an idea that was translated into action. Now, I mentioned this morning a fellow named Jack Howes, or this afternoon, rather, in the earlier session, a fellow named Jack Howes. He had an idea about building the biggest Sunday school in the world. We talked just a little bit about him. Some of you have visited up there where he preaches. I never have. I would like to, but I just flat can't find the time to do that. They baptize 250 people on average each Sunday, each week. Can you imagine that? Every Sunday, 4 men have been baptized. Average of 250 a week. Idea translated into action. I'm trying to get you to set some goals here. I'm trying to provoke you then. Not just provoke you, but provoke you to love and to good works. That you'll translate those things into action. This workshop, it was at one time an idea translated into action. Let's take a fellow named Dr. Rude. You know who he was? Dr. Rude was an associate of Louis Pasteur. He had there was a diphtheria scourge in Paris, and Dr. Rue watched his own little 3-year-old granddaughter die. And Dr. Rue said, I will find a cure for diphtheria. Oh, it's a beautiful story. I wish I had time to tell it to you. And he did. He found a vaccine for it. Because of that, you and I, see, he translated an idea into action, and you and I today benefiting from it. John Goddard, ever heard of him? He's a 15-year-old, and he made himself some goals. Now, he made 127. I wrote down a few of them here. 15-year-old boy, listen to some of these goals. Now, the numbers I give you, that's the number out of the 127, not his age. He was 15 when he wrote these. Number 5 on the list was become an Eagle Scout. He did. Number 8 was to climb Mount Everest. He did. Number 9 was to milk a rattlesnake. He did. Ever milked a rattlesnake? I milked a lot of Jersey cows. I watched a few people milk rattlesnakes, but I don't care that much about them myself. Visit a movie studio. He did. Learned to type 50 words a minute. He did. Number 50 on the list was read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. He did. Number 57, he hadn't done that one yet, find Noah's Ark. 78, learned French, he did. 79, learned Spanish, he did. 89, visit every country in the world, he did. Number 127, walk on the moon. Did you know he's already done over 100 of 127, and he's 24 years old? You see, set himself some goals. What's the purpose of that? Give it to you in a moment here. I think it'd be well for you to know. The Sunset School of Preaching, Lubbock, Texas. Ever hear of it? Ah, Richard Rogers has stood down here, maybe on this workshop, I'm not for sure. You know how it got started? 8 of my brethren sitting around drinking coffee in a cafe just out north of Lubbock. They said, you know, we need a school here to train our Spanish brethren how to preach. Well, let's start one. Okay, they all got the billfolds out and they all chipped in $10 apiece, elected a fellow treasurer, and Sunset School of Preaching started on $80. That was an idea translated into action. Any idea we have not translated into action never gets any bigger than the brain cell. Madison Auditorium, you ever seen that new auditorium, Madison? Oh, I've preached in the old one, I've preached in the new one. They call it North Stadium, those of you who are not familiar with it. Now, before it was built, Brother Iron Ore told me, he took Brother Roark, one of his elders, a full-time elder, and they went out here on the parking lot where that auditorium is now. But it wasn't there then. He said, Brother Roark, can you just imagine 3,000 people singing? He said, listen, Brother Roark, listen. Listen to me and hear him singing. Did you know that we are the only part of God's creation that have the faculty of imagination? God never gave it to anything else but human beings. And that is the ability to envision things that have never happened. And that's what they were doing. They stand around the parking lot. And they were listening to 3,000 people sing. And that idea was translated into action. Now then they just have to have two services on Sunday morning. And our preachers to about 5,000 every Sunday morning. An idea translated into action. 75 children homes we have. Every one of them started out with an idea of somebody's head. Vincennes, Indiana. Congregation been in a little 40 by 60 building for years and years and years and years. One elder, Brother Robert Nelson, had an idea. They bought some land, just like old Nehemiah. The people had a mind to work. And the first Sunday they were in the new building, 1,073 people attended. Bama Road in Houston needed $1 million single contributions. An idea translated into action. And they got it. Crossroads, set a goal for. One baptism a day. There's an idea, translated into action, they got it. Turnpike. Some members from Turnpike and Grand Prairie here. Set a goal to baptize 1,000 prisoners in the Dallas County Jail last year. I talked with some of the members today. They baptized over 1,300 into Christ last year. Did you know that one of the fastest growing congregations in the Metroplex is in the Dallas County Jail? So, start out with an idea. Translate it into action. Doesn't do any good unless we do. Okay, now then, we've got to go down to determining some of these obstacles. Now, if you're not making the progress that you desire to make and you're capable of making, it's because you're not specific enough with your goals. That's the reason. You're not specific enough with your goals, whatever they are. If you're not making the progress that you're capable of making, you're just not specific enough in goal setting. Oh, I wish I could get you sold on that. Maybe some of you get tired of hearing it and get weary and well-doing. But it's not what you are that holds you back. It's what you think you are. Well, I can't do that. Well, I never have had any business. That's what holds you back. It's not what you are. We're created in God's own image, all of us. And if you are a failure, don't blame God. He didn't make any junk. He didn't waste his time.
making second-rate citizens.
And if you're one of them, you're a self-made man. God didn't make you that way. Created us in his own image. Now, I'll give you one other illustration about a fella. James Benson Irwin. Ever hear of him? Well, yes, but you probably don't recognize that name. He was in an aircraft crash, broke both legs, broke his jaw, had a terrific brain concussion. As a matter of fact, he had amnesia for over 2 years. Treated with hypnosis, treated with truth serum. Finally got his memory back. He applied as an astronaut 4 times and turned down. But Mr. James Benson Irwin was the 8th man to ever set foot on the moon. Obstacles. Oh, yes. Lots of them. Didn't make any difference. He had a very specific goal, what he was going to do. And he did it. I just read a letter last night. Terrific letter from a sister in Christ over in Florence, Alabama. She reads the Bible. She's bedfast. Can't get out of bed. Has to be helped with everything. And she reads the Bible. It's advertised on some of the TV programs. I understand some of the brethren pay for it. And I've forgotten. Just read the letter last night and I had a lot of things to do. But she's telling about how many conversions she'd had. Reading the Bible from her bed. Can't get out of bed. How many restorations that she'd had. Obstacles, yes. Bedfast. But that doesn't keep her from winning all souls to Jesus Christ. I mentioned this morning another man. F.O. Maston, the late F.O. Maston. Who passed away just recently, a brother in Christ out in Sudan, Texas. Left a note, by the way, before he died, to Brother John Stevens of Abilene Christian. I'd like to leave everything that I have to Abilene Christian. He was worth over $50 million. Of course, it's being contested, naturally. But nevertheless, he was a man who never sold any property. On one occasion, he slipped and he sold 2 sections of land. And he said, "Mid, I've regretted it ever since." And he told me about a lot of the obstacles. I told you he was the world's biggest independent farmer, and he was. Brother Gibson, of the Gibson Stores, started out. At one time, he had over 300 stores. I don't know how many he has now, but he had over 300. You think he didn't have any obstacles to overcome? We set our little penny goals, and the first little obstacle comes up, just can't do it. Couldn't make it. What kind of obstacles do we have? All kinds of negativism. I'm not even going to go into it. I have been into it in other lectures and workshops. I will suggest this. I know a man who 4 times was turned down. No, he turned down a promotion in the business where he worked. Fully qualified. They offered it to him. The board did. 4 times. Nope. Satisfied where he was. They couldn't figure it out. A man with all of his ability. And he didn't want to be advanced. Matter of fact, they prevailed upon the company psychiatrist to examine this fellow and found out that when he was a kid, they pushed him in the swimming pool. He couldn't swim. He failed. And he had deep within him an inborn fear of failing. And when the psychiatrist finally got that straightened out, today, that man is president of the largest cookware company in the world.